His voice is well known over several decades around the Lower Mainland, one of the unique voices of radio, and he's also been involved in just about every facet of broadcasting that you can think of. Terry Bell, good morning.
Good morning, Mike. How are you?
I'm fine. You have been in the business about as long as I have. I think you started in the early 60s.
I did, 62, 63 in that area. I'm not sure I really want to dwell on how long I've been in the business. I feel old enough without dwelling on that. But yeah, it goes, even before I got paid for it, I was hanging around radio stations, generally making a nuisance of myself. I guess one place more than any other was probably CKWX when they were back in what was then quite the broadcast center at 1275 Burrard Street. People like John Ansel and Ron Robinson and Barry Clark, Cal George, Buddy Clyde, they were all there. Red Robinson, too, if I remember correctly. I hung around and spent some time in the production studios and spent some time in the control room and watching the pros, making a nuisance of myself, as I said.
Even earlier than that, though, weren't you up in Prince George for your beginning?
Actually,
of your
no, that came later. That was when I was getting paid for it.
Ah.
Not much, mind you, but I was getting paid for it. Prior to that, though, I guess I was probably in high school, junior high, probably, when I decided what I wanted to do. And so I had this little plastic tape recorder that took 3-inch reels of tape, and I would grab magazines and newspapers and that kind of thing and practice reading them and practice the diction and that kind of thing. Occasionally, I would bushwhack some family member and do interviews with them and practice the trade, as it were. That was probably, as I say, grade 8, grade 9, something like that. So then by the time I got out of high school, I had been playing radio for quite some time. When I went to see about getting a full-time job at CKWX, a fellow there you've probably heard of, Ron Robinson by name, said, well, they had an opening coming up, and I had my choice. I could either work the all-night show at WX, or, and this was his recommendation, I could go to Prince George and learn television, because they had not only an AM station up there, but they had a TV station as well. So I mulled that over for a couple of days and decided that I was going to go to Prince George and learn television from the ground up and replace a fellow named Norris McLean, who was moving to Edmonton to be their weatherman. So I went there. I started doing a midday show for a fellow named Ron East. And Ron was leaving as well because he was opening up a brand new radio station in Smithers, CFBV. And that led to him starting his own Bulkley Valley radio network, including a station, CJCI, in Prince George a number of years later. So I was up there in 63, stayed until 1970. And in that time, of course, I was only going up for the year, you know, went up, and I started doing midday, or you know, the coffee time shift, as it were. From there, I guess, started doing interview shows on television, and the big break, in a matter of speaking, was doing a show called Dance Party, which was a spin-off from the dance party that BCTV, or in those days Chan TV, was doing. Initially with Barry Clark from CKWX. Barry went on, of course, to become the rentalsman in BC. Buddy Clyde took the show over at Chan. So I did a similar thing in Prince George on every Saturday. And then, as I say, we had things like Telescope, which was the Prince George version of the CBC National version. That led to specials like the Oscar preview, you know, the half hour sort of before the Oscar telecast took over. And eventually took over doing a Huntley Brinkley type newscast at 6 o'clock every night. And that was the Prince George version of the News Hour. And so that lasted several years. And through the period between radio and TV, I was doing initially a midday show, and that led to a production manager's job, which led eventually to a program director's job, and then the TV anchor thing all rolled into one, which is what, as you know, we do with this business, or did with this business back in those days. And a lot of that was thanks to a guy named Jack Carbett, who was the senior announcer at CKPG Radio when I went up there. Bob Harkins in those days was the general manager, and he went over to CJCI and started doing a radio talk show, which he did up until a number of years ago.
What type of music were you playing during your mid-morning show?
Well, my favorite music in those days was, I guess, what would qualify as pop, so I was doing everything from obviously Sinatra and Tony Bennett and Peggy Lee and like that. And then the rest of the day was pretty much the same, with the exception of a sort of a CHQM ripoff, which Jack Carbet did between 6 and 8 o'clock at night, the dinner hour music. You know, there's a lot of Mantovani and strings and what have you. Then it got to the point where we couldn't ignore rock and roll any longer, so we had to bring that in, and it was usually block programmed from about 4 till 6 o'clock in the afternoon, or 4 till 5, I guess it was initially, and then we played country from 5 till 6. So a little of this and a little of that.
Tell us a little bit about early television, because those were adventuresome days. I remember getting into it in the late 60s. There were no teleprompters.
No.
You were working from a typed script on the desk to do your newscast. You were probably maybe two cameras, I guess.
Well, one to start with, and that was kind of interesting when you were doing a Huntley Brinkley, because you had one camera to share with two people, so it was a wide shot generally. And then we did get the second camera. That was all right. We each had our own, you know, no sharing required.
The Dance Party Show, was that recordings? Did you have live bands coming in? Did you have studio guests?
Well, there weren't too many live bands traveling in those days, although I think I kind of fixed that with Red Robinson later on with an outfit he called Jaguar Productions. People like Bobby Bear and Les Boat and the Blamers and what have you came traveling through. So we did those. But at the time with Dance Party, it was basically one camera, me with a remote board and a lavalier microphone, and standing behind the turntables, introducing the music while the kids in studio were awestruck, of course, and then danced.
There wasn't a lot of television around in those days. I guess Vancouver had TV, Kelowna had TV. Prince George, and I think that was pretty much the extent of it for British Columbia at that time.
At that time it was, yeah. Dawson Creek came along a little bit later on, and Freddie Weber with his Terrace Kitimat operation, again, just around the same time. But yeah, it was, I can't remember what the power of the station was. It was maybe 100,000 watts ERP, and that's pretty good for that day and age, I think, even for television, you know, or especially for television.
There were not really a lot of sets around in the early 60s yet either.
No, and of course they were all black and white too. You know, it's like, how's that for dating yourself? You know, but yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Anything that you care to share, interesting type incident that might have happened during those years?
In the Prince George area? Well, the first thing that comes to my mind, and I don't know why, because I haven't thought about this probably since then, but one of the things we did was started up a station softball team, which a lot of stations have done since, but remember now, we're talking somewhere between 63 and 70. And after we had played a few summers, I guess the word got around that we had some not bad ball players, and we were challenged by a group of widely scattered ages, I guess, of young and middle-aged men who thought they could really do us some harm on the ball field. Turned out they were all from the city jail. Or the Prince George Regional Correctional Center, I think they called it in those days. But there we were. So anyway, we went, and that's the first and only time I think I've ever played softball or any kind of a ball game with armed guards around the perimeter. But it was interesting, and I can't tell you right now who won the game.
Not that it matters.
No, but there was a lot of looking over your shoulder, you know.
I would imagine, yeah. Guys with guns watching you play ball.
Yeah.
1970 rolls around, and the move comes. Yeah. How did that happen?
Shortly before that, Jack Stark and his partners, who were the instigators of CHQM AM, and the year later, in 1961, was QM FM, they bought out CKPG Radio and Television. And they came up and had a look around, of course, before they made the purchase, doing due diligence, I guess. And in March of 1970, Morris Foisy, who was the VP of programming at QM, gave me a phone call, asked if I'd like to come down and be a utility hitter. If I'd like to come down, I said, sure, because I grew up here. And so that was my, you know, 1 year in Prince George, 7 years later. So I came back down here and batted cleanup for just about everything for about 2 years, I guess. Production, a lot of news work, entertainment interviews, that kind of thing. Midday, and then afternoon drive. And in June of 1977, I graduated to the morning show. And I remember that because it was the day Star Trek was unleashed on the world. So I did that for 8 years. and then went back to doing the afternoon drive.
Who were some of the people who were there during your years at QM?
Well, there wasn't a lot of motion.
It was a pretty stable environment.
Yeah, it was indeed, yeah. When I got there, of course, there was Morris Foisy, Dave Geddes, Andy Walsh, Bill Phillips. Don MacArthur was there. Don went and came back a couple of times, as did Bill Phillips. He went down to WX occasionally and then came back, and then he went down one time when they were having C-Jazz, did the jazz programs down there. Of course, we were all sort of familiar with the jazz idiom because of QMFM and shows like Gaslight and that kind of stuff at night. They were all still there when I left.
When you started there, were they simulcasting on AM and FM, or had they split?
Some day parts they were, yeah. Yeah, the morning shows were separate, but after that it kind of got, what station are we listening to now? You know, that sort of thing. But yeah, that lasted for a while.
Now, the techie buffs want me to ask you if you were there during the automation experiment on FM.
The automation
experiment. Yes, where they brought in an IGM machine to replace operators.
The carousels.
Yes.
Well, the carousels really, I don't think they really replaced operators. I think they were just sort of the first thing. They had these 10-inch reels, of course, on several rack-mounted playback machines. And somewhere in the middle of all of that were a couple of carousels with cartridges loaded into them and a pin bank, or bank of pins, if you will. And these pins determined what got played next. And so you had so many pins per hour, and they were just like push tacks that you use in a corkboard these days. They would say, okay, this row is tape number one, and this is tape number two, and tape number three, and tape number four, and then carousel one and two. And you had to alternate the carousels because you'd have this commercial followed by that ID followed by this commercial. So they're back and forth between the two carousels, which is getting a little convoluted, I guess, but it saved having operators there pushing buttons, and that was sort of the early version of, I guess, what, Maestro, which is what everybody's using these days, I guess, or most stations.
Scott and all those other variations of computers. Mm-hmm. So that was a pretty long run from 70 through 93 at CHQM,
mm-hmm.
and
it
you
was, yeah.
did a lot of different jobs, as you mentioned.
Yep.
Was it a happy time for you?
Extremely so. Extremely so. They were a good employer. You know, we often hear about lots of complaints about wages and that kind of thing from people that are either still in the business or no longer in the business or have never gotten into the business. But I must say, while I wasn't making millions of dollars or hundreds of thousands of dollars, I thought I was amply paid. I got paid for what I did, and that applied to remotes or personal appearances and that kind of thing. Some of the days were rather long because they would keep me, you know, I would do the morning show and then I'd maybe be out for a lunch or something, come back, scrape my face again and go out for a dinner, which could, as you know, run a few hours. And then you go back home and grab 3 or 4 hours sleep and start all over again. You do that 3 or 4 times a week, you know, you're burning the candle at both ends. But I was loving every minute of it.
Yeah, and there was a lot of production back in those days
there
as well, voicing spots.
And yeah. Yes, sadly, I don't have the vocal range I once had because, and I pat myself on the back for this, a number of years ago I quit smoking, but my vocal cords are nowhere near as elastic as they used to be, and I was doing impersonations in the production studios and things like that back in the early 70s, and I'd spend probably 3 or 4 hours a day after an air shift doing commercial work and narrating, and then maybe going down the street to a production house and doing narrations for one thing or another.
Freelancing, basically,
yeah.
on top of...
Mm-hmm.
So it made for long days.
That it did, but, you know, you try to fit it all in when you can, because, as you know, in this business, you either do it when you can or it passes you by.
Now, 1993, we're getting toward the end of your time at CHQM.
Mm-hmm.
Was that when the station was sold to Chum, or had that not happened yet?
Well, it had and it hadn't, because there was an AM and an FM. Prior to my departure, the AM was rumored to be sold to a multicultural station. The FM was still kind of out there somewhere because the Stark and Associates had decided they were going to unload it all. The AM eventually became CHMB, which is still functioning, and the FM was later sold to Chum. The AM side was, you know, going to be Mandarin or Cantonese, and I don't speak either. So it was the writing was kind of on the wall, you know.
It had been a very successful operation.
It had, yeah. It was extremely successful. But Jack was, I guess, getting to an age where he had other things he wanted to do, and his partners went along with him.
Now, when that ended in 93, was that your decision to leave?
It was at 93, yeah. I had been invited to join some other people as shareholders in a management company, and we were going to take over Coast 1040 and manage that with a different format to combat anybody else who might want to take over the QM format, which would be basically easy listening. So we were going to turn the Rock 1040 into AM 1040, which again would be easy listening. So I resigned in September 15th, actually, of 93, and by the beginning of October, we were actually on the air with the new format down on Pender Street. A year or so later, about a year and a half later, we were moved by the new owner of the station up to Homer Street. And so we were there, I guess, I can't even remember when I left there. I guess it must have been around the turn of the century.
2001, I believe.
Something like that, yeah. That's close to the turn of the century, I suppose.
Now, what was that experience like, being a part owner and setting up a new format, doing all that work?
Well, there were people like Brian Brenn, who actually assumed the mantle of general manager, and I did the program director aspect of it, and we started out being an easy listening station. And then Dave Abbott was available, so we started doing Q&A in the morning, followed by the Dave Abbott program, and then going back to a musical format in the afternoon. In addition to the PD chores, I also did afternoon drive. That worked well for a while. Mm-hmm. And then when we moved up to Homer Street, it became more talk and more talk and more talk. And of course, when you're doing a talk format, you have to be prepared to face the music being NW, the gigantic NW, who, you know, does talk like nobody else does. They did then and they do now. So the format suffered somewhat.
Who are some of the people who were working there with you at that time in the 1040 years?
Well, as I say, Brian Brenn, Jason Manning, who then was our music director. Jason followed us over from QM, where he was an operator. Then he came over and looked after all of our music for us. It was myself, and then Dave Abbott came along. I would think that's probably about it in terms of namely names.
Had you moved into computers by then, or was it still playing?
There were some computers when we first took over the station, and they were kind of on their last legs. We took those up to Homer Street with us, and they were still on their last legs. There was really not much movement in terms of investing in new machinery and that kind of thing. There was no Burley in the newsroom or whatever, you know. Sadly.
The old days with the old equipment and trying to keep things going when things were breaking down.
And me not being a gum chewer, you know.
Well, February of 2001, that part of your career came to an end. That era of your life came to an end. Was that a decision that you made?
Let's say that it was mutually agreed upon. I wasn't happy, and there were a lot of things going on internally that I won't share here, but it was an ownership versus management thing, and I said thanks, but no thanks.
So you became an early pioneer in internet radio.
Yeah, shortly after leaving AM 1040, wandering around and wondering what I was going to do, I was approached to do an internet jazz music program on mycityradio.com. And so I did that for almost a year, I guess. Then their funding ran out, and so that left me back on the bricks again. Not for long. I got a hold of John Ashbridge, the legendary John Ashbridge. He allowed us how there was going to be an opening at one of their newer ventures at the mighty top dog, namely NW2, the all-news station.
And this is where we ran into each other, I think, for the first time.
It was, in fact, yes. And life has never been the same since.
That was a noble experiment.
It was.
That got cut off at the knees.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a sad story.
There were a lot of very talented people hired for that radio station.
Indeed.
In addition to the backbone of CKNW News staff, mm-hmm. but a lot of people were working. I think they had a staff of, what, maybe 40 people when we were running NW2?
On the NW2 side, yeah. I would think that's fairly accurate, yeah.
And there were some very well-known names there as well. Mm-hmm. You can probably mm-hmm. remember some of the people you were working with.
There were a lot of people there that perhaps weren't so well-known in Vancouver. A lot of them had come in from chorus stations on the prairies and one thing and another, and were doing just fantastic work there in terms of writing and reading and just on-air production. It was fun.
Those people were told when they were hired that they had 3 years to make a run for it, but it didn't get much past the first year. About a year and several months.
Yeah, I think you're probably
and
right.
And we all got a phone call one morning saying not to come to work.
Yeah, it went into July of whatever year that was. We were all, you know, as you say, don't bother showing up. Okay, fine. So we were all let go one way or another. About a month after that, I got a call back to the big NW, number one, and been there ever since.
They seem to have realized after they cut everybody loose that they had left themselves a little short, and some of us, as you mentioned, were called back a couple of months later to come in and do various things. At that time, CKNW was still operating a network, which had started out, I believe, many, many years before with John Ashbridge basically at the helm.
That's right.
And we were serving a lot of interior BC stations and coastal stations.
Right.
That, of course, came to an end along with the cost cutting and another purge of staff. And you've been a survivor, and you're still
somehow there.
As we are having this conversation in November of 2010, Terry Bell is still a familiar voice on the air and probably one of the only live voices we hear during the overnight hours.
I hadn't thought about it, but you're probably right. I'm not sure what WX is doing now. I think they have one person on there instead of a crew of three or four like they used to have, but I could be wrong there. But yeah, it's live.
Everything else is coming out of the box on all of the other stations.
Yeah, the aforementioned Maestro et al.
Your job, basically, what time do you go into work?
I show up about 7:45. I have headlines at 8:30, so I put those together and tackle all the formatics that you have to do into the computer and that kind of thing, and then I start building newscasts and read them at the top of every hour.
Well, that's a pretty much all night. And I was speaking with Tom Mark earlier. Tom mentions that he comes in around 2 or 1 or 2 in the morning, I believe.
Around 2 o'clock, yeah.
Yeah, and by that time, you've pretty well got a lot of material ready for him to go over and prepare his newscast. So you probably keep pretty busy during those hours.
Yeah, there's nobody that looks after our web page. So I mount the stuff on the web page, all the news updates and one thing and another. We also send out email flashes on late breaking news or sports scores, you know, the hockey and that kind of thing. So we send those out. I do that. Hourly newscasts, also look after the electronic files, which is, you know, the old paper files are long gone. So we keep track of all of our stories and things that need updates. So they all get put ahead into an electronic file. So do that as well.
So you're doing an awful lot of prep for the day shift when
Yeah, there is a lot of that there, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then by the time Tom comes in, his morning pilot folder, as we like to call it, is hopefully full of things that will get him through 3 hours in the morning, 3 or 4 hours of the drive in the morning. And that's both text and reporter contributions and CP and CNN audio, which I'll put together for him.
So this is an ongoing thing besides being on the air and keeping people informed, as I say, probably one of two live voices during the overnight hours. Mm-hmm. If something happens overnight, you're on it first.
Well, in terms of news, yeah. That's very true. And then, of course, there are the phone calls that need answering, too. You know, I had a couple last night, as a matter of fact. There was a technical problem with a very popular program called Coast to Coast. And anybody that has a conspiracy theory is well-versed in that particular program. It runs for about 3 hours in the wee small hours. And there was a technical problem with it from the source, which we could do nothing about. But the phones went off the hook. And people not only wanted to know what we were doing to their program, but when it was going to be restored to normalcy, and I had to tell them that we couldn't do anything, but we were working on it. And of course, wouldn't you know it, I no sooner went on air and said, the program is experiencing difficulties at the source, we appreciate your patience, thanks very much, nothing we can do about it, but thanks very much, and we'll get back to normal ASAP. No sooner said that, it was restored.
And you also have to keep an ear. I believe there's sometimes nobody in Rock 101 and nobody in the Fox overnight. And if anything goes wrong, I believe alarm bells go off in the news area.
Indeed they
do. And you have to go around and give the automation system a boot if you can... get yeah. it going again.
Well, it's not the automation system with the pins anymore. It's
no, you know, computers.
Maestro and the latest computer software. Yeah.
Yeah, all of those things. Your favorite moment in your broadcasting career, a highlight that stands out in your mind?
I'm not sure that it would be any one particular thing. While I was at QM, I got to do a lot of neat stuff. I guess one of the best, or several of the best, was raising money for things like the Canadian Opera Company, many radiothons for the Vancouver Symphony Orchestra, a similar one for the Calgary Symphony, another couple of them for Seattle Symphony, and another couple of them for the Houston Symphony. Going around and meeting people that are in this musical world, and they're all professional musicians, and then meeting all of the broadcasters in their local cities who helped us pull off this radiothon. Those had to be some pretty high moments. They were just, you know, it was live radio. And it's like I always used to say during those broadcasts, was that live music was best. Well, that's an area where live radio is at its best, where it can really help out any given community by raising funds for an arm of the community, like an opera or a symphony orchestra.
Some of your favorite people you've met through the years, people who maybe have helped your career, people you've interviewed, people you've worked with.
One of the funniest people I ever interviewed was Rolf Harris. Remember him?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, extremely talented guy. Most people know him because of the My Boomerang Won't Come Back, or Didn't Come Back, and Six White Boomers, but he was also a very talented visual artist. He'd slapped together, matter of fact, he was doing one of his paintings one time when I was interviewing him on television. I'd stand there with hold the microphone way out and try not to get slopped paint on me. He was doing landscapes with a 4-inch brush. You know, just an amazing guy. A lot of musicians. I shared a stage with Ella Fitzgerald one night. Another night was Tony Bennett. Way, way back when she was still going on stage in bare feet was Anne Murray. And I think she had done 3 or 4 live shows by the time I got a microphone in front of her. So she was a very young Anne Murray. Fresh out of the gymnasium, as it were.
And your early experience with internet radio, that has grown somewhat, but not really as much as a lot of us thought it would.
Or as fast, yeah.
There are a lot of restriction on music, of course, and who's going to pay for what. Does internet radio, there are a lot of interesting stations going on out there, most outside of our country. Does it have a future?
I think so. I think a lot of it is just the various, as you say, there's issues with licensing and one thing and another, and once they get that ironed out, I think it'll start to take off more so than it has now. Right now, most of the internet radio stations, I think, are privately owned and operated by some very young, talented people who are trying to get their foot in the door and run into rights management a lot. Given that being cleared up, I think it will be. It'll become commercial radio on the internet.
Our terrestrial radio that you and I loved back in the 60s and 70s and beyond has changed a lot over the years. Does it have a future?
Well, you know, when you see the demise of things like the CAB and the RSB folks, and they're all out there trying to come up with a replacement vehicle, you do have to wonder sometimes. But I think whether it's AM or FM or satellite radio, there's always going to be a place for it because it's part of the community. And as long as ownership and management doesn't forget that and they continue to serve the community and do public service for the community, then yeah, it's going to stay around.
Anything else you'd like to throw in here as a final thought?
Well, just that I think over the years, whether I've worked with them or only know about them by reputation, there are a lot of fine people in this industry. I sort of take umbrage, I guess, from time to time when I read things, either online or in the printed version, that would lead one to believe that there is no future for radio. And I disagree with that. I would like to thank all of those who I have come to know over the years, either personally or by reputation, for keeping the business as lively as it is.
A long and illustrious career that's still going on today. We're talking November 2010. Terry Bell, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks for thinking of me.